last investigator I met with was Dr. Ghassan Abu Alfa, and to begin, we chatted about hepatocellular cancer and specifically the usual clinical situation he encounters with metastatic disease.
The classic presentation is somebody who was known to be hepatitis C, and I choose this only because this one probably is the most common risk factors nowadays in the United States, who probably was followed over several years in regard to their hep C and the potential for developing hepatocellular cell carcinoma. Maybe they were lost to follow up at some point, erupted with some lesion in their liver, and sadly, however, they were found at the same time to have some metastatic disease. That metastatic disease can very much represent itself by some lung lesions, but interestingly, in the last several years, we've been seeing more and more bony metastatic disease. And one of the cases that really fascinated us in regard to the presentation, a man who knew that he has hepatitis C, who was at his dentist for a root canal, and the dentist kept drilling and really got to a point where he felt like something is not going right in that mandible. And a biopsy was done ultimately, and believe it or not, hepatocellular carcinoma.
Wow. So when you have a patient who's presenting, as you say, with metastatic disease, what are you thinking about in terms of treatment strategy?
Pretty much the dogmatic view where every extent of cancer and every liver functionality would direct is to a certain discipline or a kind of care, it still applies. But however, definitely there are a lot of variability, and we will dig in a little bit more further into this. But in general, a small lesion, which is in a good liver, not involving any blood vessels, you probably will send this patient to surgery or an RFA. A little bit larger lesion with the same condition, good liver, and no extension to the vessels, probably surgery. Probably small amount of disease, but with bad liver condition, i.e. quite cirrhotic, probably transplant. Then probably more extensive disease in the liver, probably close to the vessels, or a certain technical limitation regard to resection, probably some form of local therapy like embolization or chemoembolization. Then you come to the point where there is either metastatic disease or, again, localized disease in the liver, but not amenable to any of those therapies I mentioned, or has failed them over a certain period of time or on certain frequency. Then you will go for systemic therapy, which, of course, is still represented by the only standard of care we have currently, which is sorafenib.
So in terms of the patients that you're considering for transplant, what's the usual wait, both locally in your place as well as nationally? And how often do you have to treat the patient prior to transplant with some kind of bridging therapy?
Obviously, this differs quite a bit based on where patients are in the country. My understanding is that really the MELT scores more to kind of direct or try to ration the livers rather than to prioritize the patients, because the, of course, limiting factor remains the number of livers that we have rather than the number of patients. But in general, there's a lot of temporizing therapies that will try to keep the patients on the list, because ultimately patients will drop off the list because of progression. This is one of the commonest things we can see. And as such, it will not be surprising if somebody is waiting to receive an embolization or some other form of temporizing therapy awaiting their role for transplant.
And what kind of bridging therapy do you generally utilize?
The one that's probably most commonly used is chemoembolization.
And where are we today in terms of the integration of chemoembolization into the patients with more advanced disease? How do you make a decision between using that modality and systemic treatment, for example, sorafenib?
I like the question, and as you noticed, I carefully used the word dogmatic originally in regard to the staging and how the therapies fall into the box. And I'm really coming to a point where myself and others in the field, where our fear is that we're discovering therapies and we're trying to fit them in the box that already is there, rather than let those therapies decide what box they should be in. And what I imply by that is that clearly when the Lovay and Low papers came out many years ago in regard to the survival benefit by using chemoembolization, clearly it applied to relatively small disease in the liver. Actually, the median size of the lesions in the Lovay paper was frankly something in the 3.5 centimeter or so. While nowadays, obviously, you can imagine we build a certain comfort in regard to those approaches, and as such, the envelope keep expanding itself. And always, you know, we're all physicians and we remember the good story and we say, of course, it works very well. And sometimes we remember that, or rather we forget that some patients have a quite large lesion and still we're trying to chemoembolize it. And obviously the median survival that clings our mind is the 3 years median survival, while truly this might be much lower. I think we presented this very nicely at GI ASCO this year. As you probably remember, we had a paper presented from Memorial where we had randomized phase 2 trials looking at embolization, bland embolization versus chemoembolization with drug-eluting beads. And the study showed no difference between the two, and obviously we questioned the need for the chemotherapy added to the embolization. But the reason I'm bringing it up, not for that point, but rather to remind you that the median survival for the two arms was 16 and 19 months. And I can tell you that in the realm of embolization, these are not the numbers that anybody is used to. They might expect that the mean survival will be much longer. And I think, however, this is the reality of the matter. At the moment, we are expanding the envelope of the embolization beyond what's expected from the Lovay and Low paper, and that's why the median survivals are coming down and rather shrinking in regard to their expense. And as such, I would expect that we have to probably at some point revise very clearly the role of systemic therapy that might expand beyond the clearly metastatic or spread out disease beyond the liver and look at patients with probably advanced disease in the liver that maybe is beyond the true envelope where embolization might help.
So I was surprised you had 101 patients in this study, and I'm kind of curious how what you reported at the ASCO GI meeting compares to what's been seen previously.
As I mentioned, the median survivors that were reported are definitely lower than what's in the literature, but I think, and this was already we spoke about a second ago, but the other matter that we reported, which is quite important, this is probably of the very few, if not the only setup where we were able to have a direct comparison between chemoembolization and embolization. Because if you recall in the Lovay paper, even though chemoembolization clearly showed a survival benefit over best supportive care, the study was discontinued early enough that we never were able to conclude if there is any benefit or not from bland embolization versus best supportive care. And that study that we reported at GI ASCO obviously brought up this into question one more time, and we were able to show clearly that it doesn't matter. And as such, you can wonder if really there is a clear need for the chemotherapy added to the embolization. I would like to add here a very important point, though. It's, in all fairness, clearly we're talking about a long spread out of time between the two studies, and the science of embolization has evolved enough that any of my colleagues who are more expert into the field can attest to that by saying that nowadays we are clear about when we call bland embolization, we're talking about embolization to stasis, where really you are knocking off every possible blood supply to that tumor, and it's really done on a very microscopic level in regard to the feeds of the tumors. It's not simply just try to put some gel foam at some big artery and hope for the best.
Actually, I kind of always thought that the concept of chemoembolization was a little bit, I don't know, strange, or I wondered about that all along. Another thing that you reported that I thought was kind of interesting was that it didn't seem like there was a relationship between the change in tumor volume after treatment and survival. How do you explain that?
Well, that's definitely a big story, and you and I have talked about that before. And I have to say that this is something that humbles all of us in regard to how to assess hepatocell carcinoma all in all from the radiologic perspective. And we're not really sure how these behaves, but I have to say that no doubt that a certain aspect of the therapy that's probably best represented by that tumor necrosis, however, that I will keep between parentheses rather than just say it flatly out because really it's not validated, it definitely plays a role. And the EASL criteria, which has been described in a chapter in a book a long time ago, really speak to that aspect, but unfortunately they were never validated and they would require so. And as such, we kind of looked into that as part of the study and we found that clearly a certain necrosis aspect might suggest an improvement in outcome. But again, I would love to see that happening with some validation in a prospective study one day.
What did you observe in terms of complications from this procedure? And do you have any sense, or maybe there's some data in terms of the relationship between the experience of the person or the group doing this and the complication rate?
Probably the first part is easier to answer, which is obviously what we observed is what we call the post-embolization syndrome, which is a classic syndrome of fevers, pain, and increased LFTs. Our team is extremely expert on that, and they definitely can understand if this is really what's expected, or if there's any further concern from this, like an infection or what have we. Obviously, there were some effects related to the chemotherapy on the chemoembolization arm related to the doxorubicin, and these are the classic side effects that you might see with doxorubicin. And again, that's why we argued that maybe you don't need the chemotherapy component. On the other hand, I really can't tell how does this stand compared to other sites, because this was only a one-site study, but obviously, I would say that this is very operator-dependent, and no doubt that the level of expertise will speak for the outcomes that you might get on your patients.
What about the issue of combining systemic therapy with TACE, particularly sorafenib? What do we know about it? And what about the use of systemic therapy between TACE treatments?
Very interesting points that, again, we discussed several times before. As you know, the concept of adding a form of anti-angiogenic therapy, and I'll start with that one because there's more of the data where it's coming from, after an embolization has been really vetted on the preclinical level over a long period of time. And understandably, when we embolize, there is a certain angiogenic effect that will evolve in the liver within 24 hours from the embolization time. And as such, you can argue that probably implementing a certain anti-angiogenic therapy within that period of time might reverse that effect that obviously might lead to further progression of disease, i.e., while we're doing something good for the patient by embolizing a tumor, let's say, on the right side of the liver, if that angiogenic surge might occur, a lesion on the left side of the liver might grow. However, the data so far have not shown that this is true. There was a Japanese-Korean study that was reported by Dr. Kudo, and in it, exactly as you mentioned, they gave sorafenib after the embolization, and it was a randomized study, but however, sadly, it did not show an improvement in outcome in regard to response or in regard to survival between the two groups. One of the arguments at that time in regard to that study that why it was not positive or didn't show the effect that everybody hoped for is simply because there was a long wait period, really in several weeks, before the sorafenib was implemented. And obviously the argument was that this angiogenic surge occurred very fast, and as such, you probably have missed the boat in that study. And, you know, to give credit to the investigators, this was done in the early times about sorafenib. People were not really as comfortable with the side effects, and everybody was concerned about any concern of giving the sorafenib early in the game after the embolization for the fear of bleeding, etc. Anyway, there was another study which was reported, as you recall, at GI ASCO last year in 2012 by Dr. Riccardo Lencioni. It's called the SPACE study, where patients were given sorafenib, really what I call through and through. In other words, they started sorafenib, were given the embolization, literally just right after started on sorafenib again randomized study, and again, it was negative, did not show any improvement in outcome between the two arms. And really putting in question this whole role of anti-angiogenic therapy after embolization. There's one, or rather two, attempts that's still ongoing. One of them is called the ECOG 1208. It's a national effort from the ECOG group that is now run by all the cooperative groups. And a similar effort is run in the UK. It's called the TACE2 study. And these two studies, truly, they have relative nuances or differences compared to the space, but pretty much it's the same concept. It will be intriguing to see where this will take us and if this might reverse what we understood so far. But as of today, it is not recommended to use anti-angiogenic therapy after embolization for the sake, quote-unquote, of a certain form of adjuvant therapy because the data does not support it per se.
So moving more towards the issue of systemic therapy, where are we today in terms of the issue of doxorubicin and anthracyclines with sorafenib? I see, again, you had a paper at last year's GI symposium, 14 patients who received this combination. I think there's a cooperative study that you're chairing looking at this question too. Can you kind of review that issue?
Sure. So I'll take you a little bit back to the startup of the SHARP trial, which was sorafenib versus placebo. That same day when the SHARP trial was launched, we launched a study in the first line setting looking at the combination of sorafenib plus doxorubicin versus doxorubicin plus placebo. Obviously, this was pre-sorafenib era, so we kind of accepted doxorubicin as a possible standard of care or an accepted standard of care. That study, which is published in JAMA already, has shown there is a clear improvement in survival for the doxorafenib arm, with a median survival of 13.7 months compared to the dox placebo 6.5 months. Now, obviously, dox placebo arm, this is what we expect out of dox, so it was not a surprise at all. But clearly, it brought up the question about if there is a clear synergy between doxorubicin and sorafenib that led to the 13.7-month median survival improvement compared to what we know about sorafenib alone, about 10.7 months. That question is the one being answered by the study that you referred to by the cooperative groups called CALGB-80802, which truly is something to be proud of, all of us, because this is the first ever NCI-sponsored phase 3 trial in HCC in the country. That trial is still ongoing, and it's already at the point where we're analyzing the first batch of the data as planned for an interim analysis, and we'll see where it will take us. And obviously, this will be a very good question to ask. What you referred to that I presented at last year's meeting is actually an interesting look in a retrospective data that was evaluating patients who fail sorafenib. If you were to keep the sorafenib on board after they fail it, i.e. they progress on it, and you add the doxorubicin, and intriguingly enough, we found that their median survival from the time they failed the sorafenib compared to historical control almost doubled. This is currently being addressed in a phase 2 study that we are about to launch. It's already IRB approved, but waiting for the final dits and bits of paperwork. And it will look specifically in patients who fail sorafenib as first line, keep them on sorafenib and add doxorubicin.
Starting to sound a little HER2 breast cancer-like in keeping an agent that's not working going, but adding in something else.
That's very true.
A couple of practical questions that we get all the time from oncologists about using sorafenib. Child PUC B or C patients, elderly patients, poor performance status.
Very good point. And if you recall from the JCO paper, which was the phase 2 sorafenib study, at that time we allowed patients who are CHOPS POB to be on the study with the understanding that we'll evaluate with the PKs and look at the adverse events profile. And truly, there was at that time no difference in the PKs, i.e. patients with a more sluggish liver, like a CHOPS POB patient, was able to metabolize the drug at the same rate like a CHOPS-PUA patient, despite that kind of worse liver functionality. Interestingly, after that, we found, and through anecdotal experience no more, that it appears to be that patients who are CHOPS-PUB don't do as well on the drug. So we looked back one more time on the data, and we found actually that the CHOPS-PUB patients might have worsening performance of the liver while on sorafenib. I have to say it's unclear to us because we didn't have a control arm. Is it related to the drug itself? Is it related to the disease itself? Or is it both? Hard to say. Nonetheless, there was another study that's called CALGB-60301, which looked at patients with advanced liver dysfunction and see how they do on sorafenib. And I have to say that the conclusions from this study were straightforward. The dose-limiting toxicity was unfortunately an increase in bilirubin, which happened more and more on the patients with a higher bilirubin at start. And it really came with the recommendation as follows. Patients with the bilirubin, which is less than 1.5 upper limit of normal, you give them the full dose of sorafenib, i.e. 400 milligrams twice a day. Patients with the bilirubin between 1.5 and 3 upper limit of normal, we recommend half the dose of that, i.e. 400 milligrams daily. And patients with the bilirubin above 3, there is no safe dose that we could report. And also, patients with albumin less than 2.5, regardless what the bilirubin level is, you might consider one pill a day. I have to say this is, again, a multi-center study, but didn't have a control arm. Some people adopt that, others don't. I personally do, because I know for sure that bilirubin might really ramp up very quickly on a patient with CHOPS-PUB when you give them sorafenib.
And what about older patients or those with poor performance status?
I would say that I'll split the older patient performance status into two aspects. In other words, an elderly person with good performance, I have no problem at all giving them sorafenib. But of course, performance tests might be a decision-making for any therapy we might give. And as expected, a performance status issue might be very well connected to their liver performance in a patient with cirrhosis. And obviously, sometimes we have to say no, unfortunately.
One other thing about sorafenib, Anything new in terms of preventing or managing toxicity with sorafenib? There was a paper at last year's ASCO looking at urea cream. You've got Dr. Lacouture there. I don't know if he's getting involved with some of these patients, but any new pearls?
At this point in time, I'll probably be able only to comment on Dr. Ren's study from Shanghai that you just referred to from ASCO, where it was a large study where patients were randomized to receive urea cream with the idea that a prophylactic use of the urea cream will prevent hyperkeratosis, which will probably be at the essence or the base of developing that hand-foot syndrome. The study was positive in that prevention. However, there are a lot of caveats to it in regard especially how the assessments were done, how blinded it was. But, you know, as I recall, Dr. Jordan Berlin, who was the commentator that day, said it's a very low-risk therapy. Why not? But I have to say that we clearly still don't understand hand-foot syndrome very well. And I think this is still an area of research that will be quite critical, not only for sorafenib, but some other of the agents that might cause the same side effects.
It's interesting. Yesterday, I was talking with someone who we were talking about regorafenib, which, of course, is very similar to sorafenib. And she was saying how she was trying that kind of urea cream with regorafenib. Of course, you see hand-foot syndrome with some of those patients. But as long as I brought that up, what do we know about regorafenib and HCC?
Not much so far. I think there's some little data, but my understanding is that, yes, it will be an area of interest knowing what the mechanism of action is, which is not really very dissimilar from that of sorafenib.
So starting to get into the issue of targeted therapy, new agents in HCC, you had an editorial approaching the era of personalized therapy for liver cancer in Lancet Oncology. You were also part of a review paper in Recent Results in Cancer Research, Targeted Agents and Systemic Therapy in HCC. What do we know about new targets and new agents?
Definitely the field is evolving and truly evolving very fast. And I think we already consumed quite a bit of time, quite a bit of effort, and frankly, also quite a bit of clinical trials using antiangiogenics. And I think there has been reports from the first line studies of brivnib, lenvatinib, and sunitinib, and sadly, all three came negative in regard to any improvement in outcome when compared to sorafenib.
And just a note, because actually I think you referred to the sunitinib paper in your editorial. The thing that struck me about that is that it was compared to sorafenib and was actually inferior.
That's totally correct. Actually, I call this trial the Sharp 2 because truly all what it did is reproduce what sorafenib does, 10.2 months on that study compared to 10.7 on the Sharp trial.
When you think about, you know, the mechanism of anti-tumor action of sorafenib and the mechanisms we understand about sunitinib, how would you explain the superiority that's observed?
Beautiful question. And no doubt that the idea was that if you try to choose a more potent and a lower IC50 antiangiogenic therapy, you might get better results. And that's a whole argument because, in all fairness, we know that sunitinib is a much more potent antiangiogenic than sorafenib is. But at the end of the day, it clearly is not all about antiangiogenesis. And I think the multiple targets that sorafenib does or has probably is where the virtue of the superiority, i.e. the antiangiogenic component, the RAF pathway, the anti-PDGF, etc.
So one anti-angiogenic I wanted to ask you about and was featured prominently at the GI symposium in gastric cancer was ramucirumab, a very interesting agent, an antibody against the VEGF receptor. Has this been looked at in HCC and what do we know about it?
So currently there is a clinical trial. It's a phase 3 trial in the second line setting looking at ramucirumab versus placebo and still ongoing. I really don't know results yet.
I know another interest of yours is biliary cancers. Can you comment on the major new research and practice trends with these tumors?
Number one is one of the accepted standard of care is nowadays gemcitabine plus cisplatin. This is based on the ABC02 study that was beautifully done by the UK group. It was a nice transition from what's called the ABC01 study, which had a limited number of patients, a primary endpoint looking at PFS when they compared gem-cis versus gem, but with the idea pre-planned to roll this into a phase 3 study, still including those patients in the final analysis and ultimately leading to an improvement in survival about 11 plus months versus 8 for the gem-cis compared to the gem alone. This is really fascinating that we have now a standard of care we can apply, and I think really it brought more attention to that disease. I think the current question that we're dealing with is, number one, is where do we go from there? Our program at Memorial is really trying to focus on adding biologics to the GEMSYS component. I have to say, however, it's interesting that the GEMSYS in our hand has not been as tolerable as it is in the UK. And question mark, many things over here. There is an approach of limiting the therapy in the UK to a certain number of cycles, while obviously in the US we've been used to treat until toxicity or progression. And in addition to that, wondering if the platform might differ in the future to come. The other thing is, obviously, we're still treating all the biliary cancers under the same umbrella, i.e. gallbladder cancer, cholangiocarcinoma, and extrahepatic biliary disease. And I would say that some consortium effort should hopefully evolve and become a reality to try to enhance our ability to recruit into those studies and ultimately see them separate, because no doubt that a gallbladder cancer, after all, is not a cholangiocarcinoma. We know that on the molecular level. And as such, probably we need to devise some experimentation that will try to make us understand each one separately.
So one final question, just as a little experiment I'd like to try. Can you reflect back on the last new patient you saw with HCC and what the issue was when you saw that patient?
I like that question because truly it was moving. Not necessarily that there was any difference in that patient, except that it was a 78-year-old lady who really had a dental procedure about 40 years ago, and now she has HCV and HCC. And I like really to keep my colleagues with the image that hepatitis C is really what we call the silent epidemic, is really something that we need to appreciate. It can happen to all walks of life. It's responsible still for about 35 to 40, and maybe sometimes in certain areas, more percent of the hepatocellular carcinoma that we're seeing. And we should not really try to connect it with a certain lifestyle or behavior. It could have happened to anybody. And it's very important to remember that we should be understanding that hepatocellular carcinoma is continuing to rise in the United States. And it's really, as you can hear from the discussion we're having, from the interest in the research, it is a national problem that's unfortunately expanding rather than shrinking in regard to incidence and mortality.
So with this lady, how did she present?
She presented simply by, again, dropping off from the routine screening. Unfortunately, many patients, probably after a while, they kind of, you know, forget about it or they get less interested in it. And ultimately, she developed some abdominal pain, a classic presentation. A certain evaluation led to the finding of disease in the liver. And ultimately, further scanning found that she has actually, again, bony metastases, as we brought up earlier.
Bony metastases. Now, did she have a biopsy?
She had a biopsy from the liver, and she actually fell on her pelvis. This is what led to the discovery of 3 fractures in the pelvis that are due to pathologic fractures.
Wow. Did she have to have surgery or radiation?
Not really. It seems that the healing was appropriate, not necessarily perfect, but I would say appropriate considering the setup. And the consultations at this point said that just focus on the systemic disease and will follow, because it appears to be that she's okay for that point.
And in terms of symptomatology, was she having symptoms? Did she have bone pain?
As I said, the liver, definitely she had abdominal pain. And obviously with the fracture, she had some pain ultimately, but not necessarily she presented with it originally.
And how is her liver function?
Liver function is very good. That's really the savior in that story, because again, you can decide therapy and going on clinical trials, etc., based on having hopefully HHPA. This brings a very important point. One of the things that I hear my colleagues always be concerned about is that patients might be referred late in the game in HCC when they are in the question or in seeking the question for systemic therapy. And I think really, as you brought up right in the beginning of the discussion, a multidisciplinary approach is very critical, and as such, patients with good discussion will be seen by medical oncologists early in the game, not necessarily with bad liver performance, so they can have an opportunity of getting some systemic therapy, as this woman will do.
When did you see her, incidentally?
Literally last week, about 8 days ago.
And what kind of plan do you have for her?
So definitely we offered her a clinical trial, which is the CLGB 80802, which I just mentioned, of doxorubicin plus sorafenib versus sorafenib. And we're just in the process of evaluating her heart condition, etc., make sure that she will fulfill the criteria.
That's interesting. How did she respond to the idea of the possibility of a clinical trial?
The clinical trial approach is, and I like the question because obviously we are responsible of education and helping our patients in that regard. As you know, in pediatrics, our colleagues do much better than we do in the adult oncology, and we have to really take the time. And I pretty much, most importantly, take the time to educate about it. I have to say, when you have some clinical trial that will offer a certain standard for everybody, it could be a little bit easier to accept or understand. I.e., I explained to her that she was going to get sorafenib regardless. It's a 50-50 in regard to Dr. Robison. At the same time, assured her that we will not offer this except if her heart condition would allow us to do so, etc. On the other hand, probably the challenge will become a little bit more in the placebo-controlled studies. And these are especially very important now in the second-line setting in HCC. And I have to say, I hear it many times that, oh, we can't accrue because of the placebo arm. And I have to say that this is a discussion that is very sensitive, no question about it, but you got to take time on it and you have to educate about what's in it. Usually the approach is to explain to the patient that yes, there is, and admit it, there is a certain altruism they have to make and it's part of the process. And that altruism, exactly how I described to a patient who came to me and said, oh, all what you have to offer me is that pill called sorafenib. I said, well, that's true, but you have to realize that there are 300 patients that took nothing but a placebo against 300 that took sorafenib to allow you to say just that pill. And it's part of the process. They have to buy into it because we improve the outcomes. Anyway, once you negotiate the trial and you explain the process and you explain that it may be a 2 chances to get the drug versus 1 chance to get the placebo, assure them that you'll monitor them very frequently. Assure them that at the scanning time, if things are not going well, you move on to something else. I think it's very important to tell when you negotiate the trial, you're negotiating the trial. Once they are on the clinical study, it's all about them. You forget about the study and you assure them you're going to continue to do what's best for them as a patient first and foremost. And I have to say, I've been really lucky and successful, I would say, with many patients. And I think it has truly with that genuine discussion, no more than that.
I'm sure it has a lot to do with the agent and all too, but you know, just thinking about this issue of placebo, because some of these newer trials with newer agents also have crossover. So you have an encouraging agent. I was just thinking about the COMFORT trials in myelofibrosis where it was ruxolitinib versus a placebo, but you know, 2/3 of those patients ended up crossing over to get the drug. I'm sure that would make it a lot easier, but that's not really relevant in this situation. What did you say to this woman in terms of toxicity? I mean, the idea of randomizing between getting an anthracycline or not is a fairly major issue.
Well, you know, the expected effects from anthracyclines are very straightforward. And of course, they are important, though. And I start with the alopecia, which patients would value. And I would say it's not really gender specific. It's everybody would worry about it. Number two is the cardiac toxicity, very critical as well. Neutropenia, we assure them that we are going to give Neulasta, which is part of the process that we give in regard to the clinical trial, is encouraged to apply it one day after the doxorubicin that we give. And obviously, some of the other changes got to nausea, vomiting, and some of the discoloration of the urine, etc. But clearly, I focus a lot of the discussion on the alopecia and the cardiac toxicity.
Interesting. Now, she is 78. Are you going to use standard sorafenib dosing?
If she end up on the trial, and I'm not sure yet, and I think now we are a little bit in the speculative mode, you and I, because I didn't see her back yet. But if we're to start on this trial, yes, we have to. I'm still from the school of thought that will say, give the full dose of sorafenib, but follow very closely. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is the dose, this is what's appropriate, and I want to give them a chance. I would say that if you were to closely follow the patients, the hand-foot syndrome, which is a drug-limiting toxicity, can be very well evaluated and prevented from going to something like a grade 3. And what I follow usually, I start the therapy, let's say, on Tuesday. I call the patient by Friday, check on them, make sure they're okay, and I see them on next Tuesday. So this way I know where they stand. I also encourage them at any time there is any redness, anything they don't like, take pictures, email it to us on their digital cameras. We'll look at them and give them some kind of guidance. And I have to say proudly, for the last 3 to 4 years, I've not seen a single grade 3 in my clinic.
Interesting.